So it's probably 1987 or so, and I've been living in Berlin for a while and really busy with the Bad Seeds and reacquainting myself with Jeffrey. You know, he'd been doing his solo band and touring for Wild Weed, and I had done the For Bible and then started doing Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and you know, our paths crossed a lot of times, and we started talking to started up our friendship once again. And he called me one night and said he was thinking of doing the Gun Club with Nick and Rami from his solo band, and would I be interested to do it? And I was just really interested to do it. I thought enough time had passed. I mean, the reason we split in 84 was just complete exhaustion, really, and frustration. So I thought this was a great idea, and we discussed it a bit, and he was telling me he was thinking of getting Robin Guthrie from Cocteau Twins to maybe produce it, and he'd gotten a friend of ours, Richard Thomas, actually had suggested kind of managing us was telling him that this would probably be a really good idea to do a Gun Club again. And so we started talking about it, and I'd been doing a lot of recording in Hansa with Nick, and I'd done some stuff with Die Haut and been visiting Neubaut and in there, and Diamanda Galas had recorded there. So it was really a great place, and it was, you know, very economical. And I thought the atmosphere would be really good to make a Gun Club record. And he thought that was a good idea, too. For me, it had like a lot of historical value because of the Boney M. had recorded there, one of my favorites. And also David Bowie and Iggy Pop had done like The Idiot. I think some of Lowe was there. U2 had done some stuff, maybe some of the stuff with Eno there. It was just like a really, you know, people knew that Berlin was a great atmosphere for a certain type of sound. And, you know, Hansa has a live room that's like a giant old ballroom. And it's just a really great live wood room. You know, and it was also economically sound compared to places we'd recorded in London. The idea for the record really was to make it sound like a Gun Club record, because, you know, we'd been doing things trying to sound a different way, and we'd had enough distance from the Gun Club sound to want to go back to it. The thing is that when me and Jeffrey do stuff together, it's a certain combination, and it comes out sounding a certain way, and I don't know, something about the mix, it always makes it a certain sound, that the mix of my style and Jeffrey's vision. Jeffrey had done that Wild Weed, which he was trying to do a more songwritery sort of record and a more modern whatever kind of record, or I don't know what kind of record he was trying to make. And, you know, I'd done the Fur Bible. I was going through a big experimental phase, and I'd been in the Bad Seeds and just doing different experiments. And what we thought we wanted to go back to was a kind of stripped down sort of sound. And we just felt we were like kind of different people than we were when we left off. And that was a good starting point for making a new record. And in Rami and Jeff and Nick, you know, he'd found a really good rhythm section. In the Las Vegas story, we'd gone into a sort of a dark pit. But a nice one. But in for the Las Vegas story, we'd done a lot of like the guitar interplay, kind of, you know, television spiral sound. And the Gun Club, what we decided to do was make the Gun Club and make a really strong rock sound and make a rock album. I think I flew to London and we rehearsed for a while. We actually made some demos with Tony Cohen, who had done Tender Prey in London. Yeah, so then we moved back to Berlin, where I was already living, and recorded the album in Hansa studio quite fast, I think. I think within 2 weeks we had done it, all of it. The decision to get Robin was, again, another perverse decision to do something. Jeffrey, through Romy, Jeffrey had discovered Cocteau Twins. and really loved the lushness and the dreaming quality. When people asked him what kind of music is the Gun Club, he'd always called it surrealism and blues. Robin Guthrie was quite a surrealist sound. Actually, Geoffrey had met Robin at a Ramones concert in London. He met Geoffrey and Liz Fraser, and they were like sweaty in the front row of a Ramones concert dancing. And they started talking, you know, he was like, oh, you're the Cocteau Twins. And found out that, you know, they were big Ramones and Stooges fans and, you know, and loved the Gun Club. And they were actually quite big rockers, Robin especially. So they befriended each other, and then the idea, I think, between them came up to work together. The sound was definitely very thought out. And also what me and Geoffrey were talked about really a lot with this album was kind of going back to music that we heard coming out of garages when we were teenagers in East LA, and the kind of rock music of the 70s we heard coming from GarageBand, which was always a mix of kind of soul music and it's like Santana or hard rock. It was a weird, very unique kind of sound. We were actually going for quite an East LA sort of sound in Berlin with the Cocteau Twins producing. So it was a little bit of a culture clash. But that was what we were always about. We were always about experimenting and mixing up stuff like that that seemed incongruous. Robin had a big hand in producing it and in making the sound. I think his version of what rock sound is was different than what our version was. And we actually quite welcomed that. So there was the fascination between Geoffrey and loving the Cocteau Twins. And, you know, I quite like the Cocteau Twins too. I like that big swirl of sound they had. Geoffrey really wanted to make a song that, you know, if we were going to use Robin, we should use him for what he does best also. You know, not only make him pervert himself and do rock music, but we were also able to pervert ourselves and do Cocteau Twins music. That was a very conscious effort to make a Cocteau Twins sounding song, you know, which I think turned out really beautiful with Geoffrey singing and us playing slide guitars. And actually, Rami played the lead melody guitar and that. And so it was a very kind of experimental collaboration. And the cover was done by our friend Klaus Kastenskjold. I can never pronounce his name correctly. Danish-American painter. And we had met him through The Fall, and because he had done a lot of The Fall's record covers, and is a unique character with unique kind of artwork, like this expressionist painting. And Geoffrey actually gave him a paparazzi photo of a Japanese pop singer, and she was like she had just won some big, you know, Japanese Grammy Award, and her husband was somewhat of a brute. And he got drunk at a party and like punched out the paparazzi and grabbed her by the hair and threw her in the car. And they were driving away and the paparazzi are taking these photos. There's this photo of this big Japanese thug driving the car, and she's in the car in total shame, covering her face. We're very into film and very into subconscious. I mean, a lot of Geoffrey's lyrics come from subconscious thought or thinking about what people's subconscious thoughts are. And that's what his lyrics are. In that book, Go Tell the Mountain, he said his kind of one thing that stuck with him was a friend of his, this guy Don Waller, who was a writer for this thing, Backdoor Man. He said, you should always write about what people don't want to hear. Geoffrey kind of took that philosophy, and the songs usually had that theme to them. Red Rhino put it out in England, and I think we had licensed it out to a lot of different people. And that was okay and good, because it was a very successful record. But in the end, that was not very good, because they went bankrupt. At that point, Geoffrey had totally transformed himself and become a health fitness freak. And he dropped a whole lot of weight. He went back to his natural hair color of brown and dark hair. And he'd gone through this weird health regime. but then mixed at the same time with really heavy drinking. It was kind of a strange time, and I remember I was heavily drinking at the time. He was really starting to get ill at this point. Even though he looked great, really what was happening is that he had cirrhosis of the liver that was diagnosed as far back as like Miami. The band was really strong. We played a lot of really like fast rock, hard rock songs. You know, it was a very intense show. Definitely the first Mother Juno tour, we were really, especially Jeffrey, like was really pushing it. He would come off stage and collapse on the floor. I don't know how much of that was that he was overexhausted because he was ill, or how much of that was that he was really, he was putting forth everything. And that was kind of how we were going at the time. We did an American tour, and I think that was kind of a typical American tour for us. It was like really good in the big cities, but we did a lot of cities, and I think we had started on our debaucherous ways again on that tour. Playing in Los Angeles was really something quite bizarre, because really when the last time we had played in Los Angeles had been before leaving on the Las Vegas story, before he moved away. And really the Las Vegas story came out, and our last gig there we probably played to 50 people. When that album came out, there was no hometown fanfare for us or anything, which was totally different in San Francisco or in New York or Chicago or anywhere where we had sell out shows. But you know, we played the Ritz in New York, but in LA we were still playing a small club to like 50 people. Half the people we knew were friends of ours. So when we went back to play on the Mother Juno tour, we played a huge theater that was completely sold out, and so it was kind of a strange experience. So we were like actually received like a European band would have been in Los Angeles. By the time we did that American tour, we had been living in Europe for 5 years or so. So we basically were seeing things through European eyes and had become quite European, had European international people in our band, Japanese and British. Our way of thinking, our approach had kind of always been that kind of way. Well, just further reaching than a local Los Angeles band, and our interests were in different cultures. But so we came back and we were received like a European band, which was like, we came back and played to like a really full house at a theater in Los Angeles. So, and then it was another situation, the Gun Club, of being in a band with a couple, which I had sworn I wouldn't do again after the cramps. That's only because you're stuck in a van and you're stuck backstage and you're stuck everywhere together, and if they have an argument, it's really bad for everyone else because you really can't get involved in it. And if you do, it does you no good. So we did like more touring. We played this concert. We're going to play this festival in Greece, a 2-day free festival. And the first night was going to be the Triffids from Australia and Pill and Public Image. And the second night was the Gun Club and the Jesus and Mary Chain. And so the first night we got to Athens, and the promoters took us to a restaurant that was kind of on a hill overseeing the site of the festival. And you could see the stage and the entire audience at this restaurant on a hill. The Triffids had played, and Public Image was set up, Pill was set up to do their show, which we also were all anticipating seeing. Suddenly, they started giving word that people were climbing in the light towers. People were like all over the PA. I think no barrier or anything. People were smashed against the stage, and it was really a big mob scene. Suddenly, what we heard was that some anarchist group had come. The mayor or governor or whatever was announced this as a gift to the people of this festival, was a gift to the people of Athens. And so they were having none of that gift charity from them. And so they showed up with full to start a riot, really. So they came with fire and Molotov cocktails. And when Public Image kept saying they delayed and delayed and delayed and wouldn't come on stage because their security people were saying it was unsafe for them to be there. And that just started a complete riot. That was all they needed because the audience got really prickly. And their blood started boiling. And so then these anarchists started throwing Molotov cocktails at the stage, and a complete riot ensued where they kind of quite literally burned down the stage. People had big poles and like baseball bat kind of sticks and stuff and started smashing everything. The entire sound booth that was out in the middle of the thing got completely smashed to the ground. All the equipment was smashed. People were running for their lives because it was getting really hairy. And so what we were up above, we watched the whole thing unfold and happen. It was really quite astonishing. I don't know. It was like a crazy, crazy riot. But, you know, this was a thing I'd been through some riots in Greece before at our concerts. I think when the Bad Seeds played, there was a big riot outside. I think the stuff gets oversold or people can't get in, and they're very passionate, I would assume, there. Another time when the Gun Club played this club gig and people couldn't get in, or maybe they didn't have money to get in or whatever, but some people came and maced the security people and kicked in the doors, and everyone came running in. And so that was quite an electric experience. And so, yeah, I mean, it was kind of crazy because then we lost all our friends in the Triffids and we didn't know where they were, and they had been gone running for their life and trying to save their equipment, and the promoters were crying. It was a mess, as you could imagine. So we went home the next day. So obviously there was no concert the next night with the Gun Club and Jesus and Mary Jane.